The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering Mac computer repairs for screen fixes, liquid damage, backup services, hard drive issues, and other problems. More information at TechServe.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. France looks within for the radicals still at large and finds them. A raid at an apartment in the town of Saint-Denis by police today kills two and apprehends seven suspected terrorists.
Exprimer toute notre gratitude.
I would also like to express all of our gratitude and admiration to the police forces. They knew it would be dangerous. They probably didn't imagine the incredible violence of the response. And they completed their mission.
That's French President François Hollande speaking once again to his nation. The notion that the violence was unexpected, the first inkling was the explosion of a reported suicide vest in Saint-Denis, is another reminder of how much deep cover the radicalized elements within France seem to have acquired. As others have said on this program, France seemed overwhelmed with understandable fear and suspicion in the wake of last Friday's attacks. One of the fatal victims was even branded in media reports as a perpetrator because of his Egyptian passport. The very structure of the European Union is part of the problem. It values freedom of capital and movement over the sharing of security information. The Eurozone is trying to maintain both a European cosmopolitan identity as well as a much older Europe of the village, the medieval church, the Europe of enclaves and echoes of feudal communities of mistrust. At the crossroads of this contradiction is the Schengen Agreement, a treaty conceived in 1985 as the Eurozone Common Currency Single Flag Europe was being formed. Schengen was ratified in 1995, and it created passport-free travel throughout Europe. Today, though, Schengen for some politicians is a code word for invasion by barbarians.
We have to stop Schengen. Schengen is madness. We have to stop Schengen. Everyone has to be able to control their own national borders, simply because when dangerous people go through one border, two borders, three borders, at least there's one of three possibilities of them being detected when they go across those borders.
Marine Le Pen speaking, the leader of France's far-right National Front Party. Le Pen is out front on Schengen after gathering momentum from similar arguments for returning to a nationalist Europe, articulated during the financial crisis, and also articulated again during the more recent refugee crisis. And now this. Camino Mortera Martinez is a research fellow and Brussels representative for the Center for European Reform. I asked her straight away, is Europe ready to be a real common Europe, or is it all coming apart at the seams?
There was kind of an ambitious ideal from the, if you want, the founding fathers of the euro, which was to begin with the single market and increasing cooperation and increasing trade and increasing movement in between countries. We will achieve some sort of a political union, which was for a while kind of there when everything was going okay. And then we unfortunately had the financial crisis, the global financial crisis that hit the European Union very hard. And we realized something that experts were saying from the beginning, that we were not really in the conditions to have what we call an optimal currency union. So indeed, I think we started to realize that's probably a bit too late, and now we're trying to sort it out.
It feels like an Italian opera in some sense, because the financial crisis, as you describe, makes all of the countries vulnerable and very concerned about their economies. And then you have this vulnerability that's being exploited by terrorists like ISIS, and there's a pulling in of each country to the other, the refugee crisis also exacerbating all of this. If I use the Italian opera metaphor, is this going to end badly? Can Schengen survive?
Even though the Eurozone crisis and the refugee crisis, now what we start to call the Schengen crisis, are kind of similar because they both derive from a lack of cooperation and a lack of solidarity, I don't think they are the consequence of one another's. No matter what the economy looks like, countries are normally very reluctant to give up their powers on some very core competencies like migration and counterterrorism. There is more populism, there is more feeling against migrants and all these sort of things, but it is not necessarily the consequence of one another, as I was saying before.
But you're hearing talk about the French are afraid of what's going on in Belgium. The Belgians and the French are suspicious of what's happening in Germany. And then, of course, there's the Marine Le Pen nationalist movement that has analogs throughout Europe that closes Europe off to everyone and even talks about expulsion of supposedly assimilated Muslim and other ethnic groups. Does this have momentum now?
Well, I think the populist movements around Europe have been on the rise for a while. But that's like a very simple, that has a very simple answer. It's just people who have been in a very dire situation for a while turning to people, giving them very easy solutions out of these problematic times that we are living. So you've got these people telling you, you know, we will solve the terrorist problem if we just like expel all Muslims or close the borders or whatever, when that's absolutely not true. So unfortunately, I think if Europe doesn't get its act together in some of the crises that we're experiencing at the moment, notably indeed the refugee one and the terrorist attacks that are still ongoing in the whole kind of Western Europe, then the big winners will be the populists. That's actually something that scares me a lot. In a globalized world, you cannot simply just be on your own. And the European Union has worked for some years. Now there are some problems that we need to fix. But it doesn't mean that because we need to fix these problems, we need to just like dismantle the whole thing altogether. We just need to come up with solutions for new problems.
Well, let me push you then, personally. Have you had to think about your own identity in the last few days? Are you a European? Are you something else? Would you consider becoming an immigrant, maybe to get out of this whole frightening pillar collapse, as you call it?
Well, I'm an immigrant myself. I'm Spaniard working for a British company in Brussels and married to a French. So I think I'm probably the most European it can get. And my own country has benefited a lot from the European Union, from being open, from having examples around us and countries around us that kind of help us going through a very traumatic transition from a dictatorship to democracy. So it's very, very difficult to convince me that Europe is not worth fighting for, of course. And I think that the European Union should be a good project for me, that I travel and I have a foreign sort of family on the making and all these sort of things. But it should also work for a Greek person that has never left Greece. It should also work for my unemployed Spanish friends, and it should work for everybody, because if it doesn't work for everybody and it only works for a small proportion of people, then we will not have succeeded at all.
Camino Mortera Martinez is a research fellow and Brussels representative for the Center for European Reform. Camino, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
There's also rethinking about borders in the United States. Should we pause on the refugee resettlement program? Is it time to be cautious or time to be compassionate?
This is Eric from Philadelphia. Cautious and compassionate need not be mutually exclusive terms. These are dangerous times, and we in the West are facing a powerful foe who will use any means to divide, disrupt, and eventually destroy civilized societies like ours. Why shouldn't we take the time to thoroughly vet who's entering our country? Something I don't understand is why refugees should be resettled into American society anyway. Their stay here should be temporary, and they should reside in well-managed, secure refugee facilities.
This is Scott in Portland. In the face of evil, we must rise above. Allowing fear to compromise our values is letting them win. Many great moves forward throughout history have been about overcoming hate by not stooping to the level of which we oppose.
This is The Takeaway. Could the United States have a rethink of its own border principles within its own borders? The response to terrorism has quickly developed into a conversation about states who now won't permit Syrian refugees in their borders. Last night, the White House talked with some of the governors to discuss how this rejection of Syrian refugees might complicate the task of resettlement groups already working to resettle immigrants. Immigrants who may have to choose now between states with different policies. Could those refugees welcome in one state eventually have trouble in another unwelcoming state if they travel? Bosnian refugee Errol Kekic is executive director of the Immigration and Refugee Program at Church World Service. He's been here since 1995. He's proud and he's worried right now.
Well, this is one of the proudest traditions that the United States has, welcoming those in need of assistance and safety. And I personally benefited from it. I certainly hope that this tradition will continue in days to follow. We can do both, John. We can protect the national security and be compassionate and help refugees. In fact, the United States has the most robust system for vetting all refugees that are coming to the United States. So things that have happened in Paris can never happen here.
What problems are you having specifically with the organizations that you're familiar with?
Well, we are looking at about 33 states at this particular moment that have expressed their hesitation to accept Syrian refugees. This is very troubling for a number of reasons. Number one, the governors themselves don't necessarily have the legal right to prevent resettlement in their state. Unless they're prepared to build walls and fences around their states, they can't control
who comes
in
about.
And out.
People are prepared to build walls.
Well, certainly. This is an election season, and scoring political points is always easier on backs of people who can't speak for themselves, and that's what they're doing precisely to refugees at this point in time.
Which relates to our history. I mean, there's also plenty of history in America where we do shut the door, where we slam the door, where we put people in camps, where, I mean, what history here does America need to focus on to really get beyond this moment?
We have welcomed over 3 million refugees into this country in the last 40 years, and none of those refugees have been accused of terrorism-related activities. Just since 9/11, we have admitted more than 750,000 refugees to the United States. They come here to start their lives. This is not a program that gives them handouts. This is not a program that creates dependency. This is the program that only and simply gives them a chance. Secondly, from my personal experience, I feel integrated. I feel I was welcomed here. I feel I was given a chance, and I feel that I was able to make it.
But look into your heart. Let's say three Bosnians come over here and commit some horrible crime. You know that somebody's going to ask you a question.
I do.
But I'm so outraged that you have to carry that. Timothy McVeigh committed terrorism in the United States, radicalized in the United States. Nobody asked me about anything.
Right.
The fact that I was Christian.
Right. Well, and we have moments now where the same politicians that are saying, let's prevent refugees from coming into this country because they are a security risk potentially, are the ones that are saying that we don't need any security background checks on people who are buying guns and then going into kindergartens and shooting kids. I mean, this hypocrisy is really what is at stake here. We're not talking about real threat. We're talking about manufactured threats that came from the fact that there is a potential chance that one of the attackers in Paris might have had a Syrian passport. What they're not saying is that other attackers were clearly homegrown French and Belgian citizens. I have not heard a single politician say, let's not let French people in because of this. So I think we just need to really be objective at this particular point in time. Cool heads must prevail. This is a knee-jerk reaction that is preying on people who can speak for themselves.
But it's having solid, tangible consequences to your work.
It does. Yes, it does. And we have started receiving letters yesterday from various states and governors basically ordering us to not do resettlement in their states.
Well, let's hope we're not having a Schengen discussion or a Schengen rethink here in the United States. Errol, thanks so much.
Yeah. Pleasure.
Bosnian refugee Errol Kekic is executive director of the Immigration and Refugee Program at Church World Service. In a world of violence and disaffected young men and women growing up in lands with no assured future, the idea of running away to join the jihad has become more plausible and even a dream come true to some. The Syrian rebel group al-Nusra has similar goals as ISIS or Daesh, although they are focused on toppling Syria's besieged President Bashar al-Assad. Nevertheless, al-Nusra, like other groups in Syria, is benefiting from the influx of young people anxious to get training to go and fight or travel the world and kill. Vice News filmmaker Medyan Darya had exclusive access to youth camps where Nusra field commanders train boys to be the next generation of jihadists.
My father reminds me of Osama bin Laden, who terrorized and fought the Americans. and one day my father will be like him, and I want to be like Osama's son.
That's Abu Ashaq, a young boy training to be part of the next generation of Al-Qaeda, speaking to Vice News. Kevin Sutcliffe is head of news programming EU for Vice News. He's the executive producer of the Vice documentary Inside the Battle, Al-Nusra Al-Qaeda in Syria, a portrait of the sophisticated jihadist cradle for training children who want to become killers.
I think one of the most extraordinary things about the film and the most chilling thing is that we spend a lot of time with some very, very young boys, some I would say 7 or 8 or 9, as they're going through academies and being trained and being indoctrinated into the propaganda of Al-Qaeda. Al-Nusra saying it quite openly, we are preparing the next generation, and that is the most chilling thing in this film. The takeaway from the film is I think, very bleak and very chilling. The film itself, We've had some access before to Al-Nusra in this area by having a track record of reporting in the region. We're able to reach out and to try and get some access. It's not an easy process, and it's a process which we have to balance carefully of getting the access over getting the ability to report what we find. So in this case, it took quite a lot of planning, and there was a way in which we could spend an amount of time in this area with Al-Nusra. Obviously, we are their guests. They are armed and dangerous people. And so the film, I think, reflects fairly what we found whilst working under those conditions.
Do these young men and boys have a sense of their future? Will they grow old and have children and families in this group? Or are they all going to fight? Or do they yearn, like the suicide bombers, for some sort of martyrdom?
Well, I mean, the boys we all we filmed with were all dressed in camouflage and fatigues and seemed to range from, I mean, to be honest, just above the toddler, the 5 or 6 year old, to the teenager. And they all seemed to be full of the certainties of the teachings that they'd been having going through what the Al-Nusra teacher called an academy. And so they were full of the certainties of going to war, of jihad, of what they were going to do. There was death to America, it's kill the Jews. It was that. It was a very, very bleak, very single-minded repeating of messages. And, you know, you could see that from the scenes in the film. Each of the scenes really seemed to be where you were seeing them be designed to think very simple, narrow thoughts. I don't know, but we can't see from the film that any of them had a horizon beyond the war that is encompassing them and one that they're being prepared for.
Are they interested in, you know, bombing the White House, or do they have a particular message for U.S. forces fighting in the region?
Well, I think the message is the message of Al-Qaeda over the years. And, you know, we're all familiar with the death to America, and, you know, the flags will be raised over the White House. And that rhetoric is a sustaining rhetoric of those sorts of groups. In reality, they are controlling a portion of a chaotic state that's been in civil war now for a number of years, and that in itself sends a message out to other groups like them and their affiliates in other places. It's worth thinking about what's going on in Iraq, what's going on in Yemen, and in other places where they do have influence. So in that sense, their successes in Syria do send a message out to those who are like-minded. I mean, whether they've got the wherewithal to mount any concerted attack outside Syria obviously remains to be seen. We've seen in the past that there have been spectacular events, but as a sort of army, it's a low-tech army with rockets and machine guns and tanks. It's not an air force. It's a very low-tech and committed army that can take ground and defend ground, but it's more, I think, the message is the one that comes out to the like-minded around the world, which is, look, we are here, we've established ourselves, we are strong, and look what we are doing. And then on top of that, you get the anti-American, anti-Jewish rhetoric.
You can see Vice's documentary Inside the Battle, Al-Nusra Al-Qaeda in Syria, at thetakeaway.org. Kevin Sutcliffe is head of news programming EU for Vice News, and he's the executive producer of the Vice documentary Inside the Battle, Al-Nusra Al-Qaeda in Syria. Kevin, thank you so much.
Thank you, Joe.
So we're in a week of thinking about borders near and far in Europe and here in the United States. Talk of increased security near and far. in Europe and here in the United States. We're also talking about American principles of generosity, Americans' abundance of soft targets for terrorists, malls, cities, streets, parks. Think about it, and it'll make the hair on your head stand on end. Are we safe? That's really the question. This week, New York City Police Commissioner Bill Bratton gave this pep talk to some new recruits.
The world is changing even as we stand here. The world changed dramatically over the weekend. And the assignment for which you have volunteered, that assignment, there is now no more essential assignment in the world of policing.
Thank you, Commissioner Bratton. Joining us now is Michael Downing, Los Angeles Police Department Deputy Chief and Commanding Officer for the Counterterrorism and Special Operations Bureau. Michael, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
This is kind of the hardest question. You can't say nothing bad will ever happen. You have to say that people should be safe and confident. What do Americans do to protect against soft target attacks, exactly like the one that we saw in Paris?
Well, first we have to, just as Commissioner Bratton said, we have to realize that the world has changed and we have to find ways to participate some way in leading beyond the walls of our own businesses, our own homes, and our own institutions to say that, yes, there is a threat and it's real, and not get paranoid or over-anxious about it, but learn how to partner and participate so that everybody plays a role. And I think that's what we need to do in America. Our optic is 2,200 miles between the West Coast and the East Coast. And what happens on the other side of the landmass, the 9,000 miles, impacts us every day. And I think we just have to have a better appreciation for that.
Now, do you have a list where you say, all right, likely targets and likely assailants, and are Syrian immigrants, refugees on the top of that list of assailants right now?
Oh, I wouldn't say that. We do have a list. Obviously, we have a list of targets. We have critical infrastructure that we protect, we do assessments on. We know our soft targets. We mass gathering points, stadiums, bus rail, communities, Jewish communities specifically, malls, et cetera. So with those, we try to shore up the vulnerabilities. We educate our private sector partners. We partner with them. This morning, in a few hours, I have a meeting with the heads of private security that represent 45,000 private security guards in Los Angeles just to leverage that resource. But to say Syrians are part of that optic that we're looking at, absolutely not. Now, there is a risk that, as happened in France, that people may come in on the radar or come in with that wave. And I think that we have to be very sophisticated in our approach to vet that properly.
Well, there's also the homegrown terrorism issue, and we've got a lot of experience of that in the United States. There's a lot of experience with it on the West Coast, up in Idaho, in southern Michigan, in other places around the country, the militia movement, the abundance of firearms in the United States. How would you characterize a homegrown radicalization phenomenon in America that would be an analog to the French homegrown phenomenon, which is very, very different? It includes immigrants and people who've been there for a long, long time and particular issues related to France. We have our own issues. How do you see that?
We certainly do. I mean, in France, I was there after the Charlie Hebdo attack. I participated in a delegation with NYPD and LAPD, and we studied that. And as you know, the Muslim population in France is 10%, but the Muslim population in Paris is 47%. And I think the strength that we have in this country is our Muslim population feels American. There's an American Muslim identity. And, 99% of our communities feel just as responsible for protecting the values of our country as we do. Now, with that said, there is a kind of an exponential trend toward homegrown violent extremism in this country. And we have to be aware of that. And we have to deal with it, both on the prevention side, the interdiction side, and similar to how we managed the gang problem in Los Angeles. The 70s and 80s and 90s, we declared war on the gangs, and that certainly didn't work. But when we developed a balanced approach where, sure, you have to interdict, you have to arrest, you have to prosecute, but on the other hand, there are opportunities to build off-ramps for people, where you look at diversion programs and youth development and job placement and those kinds of programs. And I think in this space, there's room for that. There's room for this intervention as long as there's no mobilization to violence. And I think that's something we have to look at. However, even if we say it's a low-level but high-consequence threat today, it's increasing. We've had more homegrown violent extremists in the last 12 months than we've had in the last several years. So it's something that this country's faced with, and we really have to deal with it. And I wouldn't say it is a Muslim problem, and it's not a Jewish problem, it's not a Christian problem. It's a human problem that all the interfaith and the entire whole of community needs to get involved in and deal with this.
All right, last question, and I hope it's going to be good news. Strip out, as you just did there, and I'm so glad you did, the religion and the ethnicity. As a pure law enforcement counterterrorism expert, eight people decide they're going to do something. They get the weapons. They coordinate themselves. They create a plan to attack soft targets. What is the point, looking at the Paris attacks, where you think you can interdict them, that basically there's something that they have to do, a step they have to take that's going to pop them above the radar?
There's many steps they have to take. You know, there's recruitment, there's funding, there's pre-operational planning, there's behavior that they're engaged in that we have to find out about. Now, just as Director Comey said, this issue of going dark, where social media companies have developed end-to-end encryption, it makes us blind. Even legally, when we do warrants and whatnot, we can't see what's happening. And I suspect after they forensicate the phones and the computers from the evidence they collected, we're going to find that they used encrypted software to communicate. However, with that said, there's still behavioral patterns that we could look out for. We ask communities to be aware of suspicious activity which has a nexus, whether it be pre-operational planning, surveillance, the purchase of products that are unusual, those kinds of things. So law enforcement has limited resources, but when you look at communities, you know, just in Los Angeles, we have 4 million people and 45,000 private security guards and 10,000 cops in the city of L.A., we need eyes and ears, not to be paranoid, not to profile people or stereotype people, but certainly profile criminal behavior, and that's what we're asking for. In L.A., we have an iWatch program, iWatchLA.org, 877-A-THREAT, and we really push that out to ask communities to cooperate with us.
Something that can be replicated around the country. Michael Downing, thanks so much.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you.
Michael Downing is L.A. Police Department Deputy Chief and Commanding Officer for the Counterterrorism and Special Operations Bureau. One of the casualties of the Paris attacks last Friday was the long-planned 24-hour webcast all-star marathon event about climate change hosted by Al Gore leading up to the still-scheduled climate talks in Paris later this month. Out of solidarity with the French people and the city of Paris, we have decided to suspend our broadcast of 24 hours of reality and live Earth, he read a statement on the concert's website during hour four of the broadcast. He expressed condolences for the victims. The suspension, of course, was inevitable, but 100 years from now, which story will we consider more important to the world, terrorism or global warming? Think about it. Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send a tweet to @TheTakeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.